I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're here again to really plunge into some fascinating stories, looking closely at the sources behind them. Today, we're doing something a bit different. Not a huge historical event, not a big scientific thing, but one single object. Our mission, really, is to unpack everything we can find, oral history, a really detailed witness account, museum records, all focused on this one artifact. An artifact that kind of defies easy answers, leaves you thinking. And we want to start this deep dive right at a moment of discovery, almost like you're right there with us. So imagine you're in this storage room, county museum, dimly lit, quiet. You almost smell the old paper, you know, dust motes floating around. And there's this old trunk, heavy wood, looks like it's seen better days, definitely been sealed up for, well, generations. The lid starts to lift, slow, kind of creaky. And then from inside, from the dark, something catches your eye. It's a tiny gleam. It's metallic. You lean closer. It's the brass head of a pin, like a simple, ordinary pin. But here's the thing. It's shining, like really shiny. As someone polished it this morning, which is impossible, right?
Because it's pinned to this fabric that's clearly a century old. And the museum records are clear. Nobody's opened this trunk, not for decades. So this isn't just some odd detail. It's the first thread, the start of a really unsettling story that's just been waiting. One of our sources puts it so starkly, it really sticks with you. This is the real Raggedy Ann. Before the movies, before the glass case, there was her.
Yeah, and what's so striking here, I think, is how an object, and we're talking about a simple rag doll, essentially can gather such a dense, almost mythic layer of history around it. It really does blur the lines, doesn't it, between what we might call folklore and something deeply personal, a lived or at least profoundly felt experience for the people involved. If we kind of step back and connect this to the bigger picture, it's really a testament to how stories themselves, much like the objects they cling to, can carry this imprint of the past, an imprint that keeps resonating, you know, long after the actual events are just memories. So for this deep dive, we're going to be guided by some core themes that just jump out from the sources. There's this idea of intense, maybe even unnerving attachment. Then there's the chilling concept of, well, a cursed object. What does it even mean in this context? And finally, the power of a warning. A warning passed down through time, literally pinned to the object itself. The format of our source material, this oral history, is absolutely key here. It's not just dry facts. It gives us the direct accounts, sure, but it also captures the feeling of it all. You get the raw emotion, the fear, the maybe irrational interpretations of those who are there. And sometimes that subjective truth, that lived experience, tells you more about the uncanny than any purely objective record ever could.
Okay, so let's go back. Back to the very beginning of this doll story. We need to travel to 1903, rural Vermont. You've pictured a much quieter time, simpler maybe. Life dictated by seasons, by necessity. And in this setting, you have a farmer's wife. The sources describe her hands, probably rough from work, but sewing with real care, real love. She's making a rag doll, not bought from a store, but created specifically for her daughter, Clara. And this wasn't just any doll. You can almost see it, can't you? Simple button eyes, maybe mismatched. That bright red yarn hair, the sources really emphasize the color. And a little dress, blue calico, probably made from scraps they had around the house. For Clara, this doll wasn't just a toy among others. It was the toy, her constant companion, carried everywhere, slept with, whispered to, just inseparable, part of her world.
That's a really important point, the handmade aspect. In that era, making something for someone, especially a child, carried immense emotional weight. It makes you think, doesn't it? What kind of connection do we form with objects crafted just for us, especially in childhood? Some anthropologists talk about this idea of enchanted materialism, where objects, particularly handmade ones, weren't seen as purely inert. They could be imbued with a presence, a spirit almost. That idea was maybe more common then than we realize now in our age of mass production. So for Clara, the doll wasn't just stuff. It was an extension of her, wasn't it? Tangible comfort, security, a focus for her imagination. This initial bond, this deep, almost primal connection between the child and the specific object, it's absolutely crucial. It sets the stage emotionally for everything that follows. It makes the later events, the unsettling stuff, feel so much more potent, so much more wrong somehow.
Exactly, because that innocent bond, that comforting presence, it didn't stay simple for long. It started to shift. Even in those early days, there were signs, things that made people uneasy. This is where the story really takes a turn, isn't it? It moves from just heartwarming to, well, intriguing, maybe a little bit creepy, because neighbors, other family members, they started noticing things about Clara's doll, peculiar things, the main thing. It wouldn't stay put. Not in a way that made sense. It had this uncanny habit of relocating itself. It would just move.
Yeah.
And not just falling off a chair, you know. Significant moves.
Right, moves that defied easy explanation, not just a child leaving it somewhere different. Something else seemed to be going on.
Yeah, the oral history is full of these specific examples. They really paint a picture, don't they? A slow buildup of strangeness in this ordinary farmhouse. Like, sometimes they'd find the doll sitting right up in the window, button eyes looking out at the road, as if it was watching or waiting. It was supposed to be on a shelf in Clara's room, maybe, but then suddenly it's on the main staircase landing, or even down in the kitchen.
Hmm. Places it shouldn't logically be without someone moving it.
And then there's the barn loft. Apparently, Clara rarely went up there dusty, maybe unsafe. But the doll would turn up there. How?
That's a good question, especially if the child wasn't known to go there alone.
But the one that really gets you, the most unsettling one. They found it inside the locked pantry.
Locked.
Locked.
Secure.
Secured. Yet somehow the doll ended up inside. Imagine trying to rationalize that when a rag doll seemingly moving itself around the house, even getting into locked rooms. That image, the moving doll, it changes everything, doesn't it? It's not just a toy anymore. It's active. It starts messing with your sense of reality.
Absolutely. And what's fascinating from a psychological perspective is how these seemingly small acts, a doll appearing somewhere unexpected, start to sow these deep seeds of unease. It forces that fundamental question. Is this just a child's imagination running wild, maybe misremembering where they left it? Or is something genuinely anomalous happening? The doll's constant movement challenges our basic assumptions about inanimate objects, doesn't it? Our understanding of physical boundaries. And this is before Clara gets sick. It creates that feeling psychologists call cognitive dissonance. You believe dolls don't move on their own, but you're seeing evidence, or at least hearing consistent reports, that this one does. It's uncomfortable. It really makes you wonder how our minds grapple with anomalies. When something breaks the rules of the physical world as we know it, it forces a reevaluation. What's actually possible? For Clara, maybe these movements just made the doll seem more alive, more like a real friend. Maybe it reinforced her bond. But for the adults, the neighbors, you can bet that's when the first whispers started. Something's not right with that doll. Something's off. It starts to chip away at their sense of normalcy.
And things definitely got more off. The doll's strange movements were unsettling enough. But then the story takes a much darker, sadder turn. The narrative directly links the doll's behavior to Clara falling ill. Seriously ill. And as Clara's health declined, the whole feeling in the house apparently changed. It wasn't just sadness. It was something else. Clara's mother, the one who made the doll, remember she swore the house felt colder at night. An actual physical chill. But it wasn't related to the weather. It was this internal coldness seeping into the rooms. A tangible sense of dread, almost.
That's a common element in these kinds of accounts, isn't it? That sense of environmental change alongside personal tragedy or uncanny events.
Yeah. And during this time, the doll itself seemed to change, too. Or at least how they perceived it changed dramatically. It wasn't just moving anymore. Its appearance seemed altered, reflecting the gloom in the house, maybe mirroring Clara's fading vitality. The source material is specific here. That yarn hair, once bright red and cheerful, it looked darker now. Muted, like the life was draining out of it.
Almost like it was absorbing the darkness.
Maybe. And the button eyes. Usually just simple, innocent buttons. But now, they said, the way they caught the lamplight. It was different. They described them like wet stones, reflecting light with this cold, steady look. Almost watchful. Definitely not comforting anymore. That's a powerful image. Wet stones, cold, hard. Maybe I'm blinking. Right. It wasn't the same doll. Everyone felt it. Something had shifted. It felt subtly wrong. Maybe even menacing. And then there's Claire's own account. In her illness, quiet in her room, she apparently whispered something to her mother. She said the doll talked to her at night.
Talked to her?
Yeah. It wasn't just her silent friend anymore. It was confidant. And it made her a promise. A really profound and deeply unsettling promise. The doll told her she would never, ever be alone.
Wow. Yeah. You would never be alone. That's incredibly potent, isn't it? Especially coming from a doll to a sick child. If we think about that, it taps right into that profound human need for comfort, for companionship, especially when you're facing something frightening like illness, and particularly for a child. Mm. Whether you interpret that promise as, you know, a child's fevered dream-seeking solace or something genuinely spoken by...
And well, by
by the doll.
It's powerful either way. And those physical details you mentioned, the darker hair, the eyes like whetstones, they're so important. They're not just descriptions. They actively transform the doll and the narrative, don't they? It shifts from beloved toy to something, well, maybe predatory isn't the right word, but certainly altered. Something reflecting the fear and dread in the house.
Yeah, predatory or maybe just aware. In a way, it shouldn't be.
Right. And it forces that question about objects and emotion. Does the doll somehow become cursed by the tragedy it's witnessing? Does it absorb the intense grief and fear?
Yeah.
Or does it have some kind of dormant quality that gets awakened by all this strong human emotion, by the vulnerability?
It's impossible to know, isn't it?
Exactly. But imagine being the mother. You made this doll with love. Now your child is fading. The house feels wrong, cold. And this object of comfort starts looking malevolent. It's this terrifying mix of grief and the uncanny. It would make you question everything, your senses, your sanity even.
And that promise, you would never be alone. It hangs in the air, doesn't it? Especially knowing what came next. Because Clara didn't get better. The heartbreaking reality is she died before spring came. Just gone too soon. In the immediate aftermath, the family was obviously devastated. And initially, they kept the doll, maybe out of habit. Or maybe they couldn't quite let go of that last connection to Clara. Or maybe they just didn't know what to do with it after everything.
It's understandable. Grief makes people do things or not do things that seem strange later.
But the doll, its strange behavior, didn't stop when Clara died. If anything, it seemed to continue, maybe even intensify. It layered this chilling dread on top of their grief. Any comfort it might have represented was just gone. They talked about its head, how it seemed to turn, to follow them around the room with its button eyes.
Ugh, that constant silent watching.
This persistent watchfulness, like it was still there, observing the living, refusing to accept that Clara was gone, an active presence. Then one morning, the tension just broke. The rocking chair where they often left the doll, where it seemed to keep its vigil, it was empty.
Gone again.
But this time it wasn't just moved somewhere else in the house. It wasn't lost. It had gone somewhere very specific.
Oh, no. Don't tell me.
They searched, probably with this horrible feeling growing inside them. And eventually they went to the graveyard, and there it was. This is the image that really sticks from the sources, waiting on Clara's fresh grave at dawn.
Oh, wow.
Its little blue calico dress was damp, wet from the morning dew. The fabric was clinging to its stitched arms.
Like it had been there all night.
Exactly. Like it had kept its vigil right there all night long. Fulfilling that promise, you would never be alone, in the most literal, most macabre way possible.
That is profoundly unsettling. The physical manifestation of the promise. It just transcends everything, doesn't it? Life, death, the boundary between object and something else. It suggests this attachment, this focus that just persists beyond any kind of human understanding or expectation.
It's the ultimate fulfillment of the promise, but in the worst way.
Absolutely. And those images, the graveside dawn, the duet dress, they are incredibly powerful, aren't they? They paint this picture of deliberate action, of commitment. A silent vigil kept by a rag doll. That's what chills you. The intentionality it implies. The dew suggests it was there for hours, through the night, just waiting. Silent witness at the grave.
What must the family have thought?
Yeah.
Or felt, seeing that?
How do you even process that? How do you rationalize an object behaving with that kind of macabre devotion? It's beyond explanation. That had to be the breaking point, surely. It moves beyond grief or superstition into something terrifyingly real for them, pure dread.
Yeah, this wasn't just a sad reminder anymore.
No. At this point, the idea of it being a cursed object isn't just a possibility. It feels like a certainty for them. It's cemented. The doll crossed a line. It became this active, disturbing presence that refused to let go. It asserted its own chilling will.
So after that morning at the grave, well, things changed definitively. The doll's reputation was sealed. It wasn't just odd anymore. It was feared. Nobody in the immediate family wanted it after that. How could they? It became the symbol of dread, not love or memory. One account in the oral history just calls it a weight, like its presence was physically heavy. Or a cold spot in the room.
You can almost feel that, can't you? The psychic weight of it.
Yeah. So it started getting passed around. Through wider family, maybe friends trying to help. Passed through generations, apparently. But the story was always the same. Eventually, whoever had it just couldn't bear it anymore. They had to get rid of it. They couldn't stand its silent company, that feeling of being watched.
Did they try to destroy it? That often comes up in these kinds of stories.
Oh, yeah. The sources mention attempts, trying to burn it, trying to bury it deep somewhere. But it seems it either always came back somehow, reappeared, or maybe its negative influence just continued in other ways. Accidents, bad luck, that feeling of coldness.
So discarding it didn't even work reliably, it just reinforced its power, perhaps.
Exactly. It became this unwanted burden, this legacy of sorrow and unease they couldn't shake. So eventually, this journey from cherished toy to object of terror, it found its endpoint. Not in the family attic, not destroyed. It ended up in the county museum. Not on display, though.
Right, contained.
Yeah, relegated to a locked trunk in storage. Hmm. Isolated. An attempt to finally put it away, to sever its connection to the living. Almost like imprisoning it.
A desperate measure, really.
And inside that trunk, that's where we find that final, really stark image. That piece of physical evidence summing up its whole history. A scrap of paper, yellowed with age, pinned to the doll's dress. And on it, in this shaky handwriting, like someone wrote it quickly, maybe fearfully, just four words.
Positively do not touch.
Yeah, positively do not touch. Not your standard museum label, is it?
Not at all. That's not curatorial language. That's personal. That's a warning born from experience.
Exactly. It feels like a desperate plea passed down. A raw instruction based on, you know, a century of unsettling encounters. It's not about preserving the artifact. It's about protecting yourself from it.
That note is so compelling, isn't it? It's more than just instructions. It's like a condensed history, a physical testament to the doll's perceived power and the fear it inspired. It speaks volumes about the negative interactions, the consequences, real or perceived, that came from getting too close, from ignoring its nature. It really makes you ask, what does it take for an object to earn that kind of reputation? To have such a direct, visceral warning attached to it, even within the supposedly objective walls of a museum.
That's extraordinary.
And that shift you described, from personal heirloom initially comforting to this public yet hidden contained artifact, it's significant. The museum becomes a sanctuary, doesn't it? Not just for the doll, but maybe more importantly from the doll. A way to archive its story, yes, but also to try and neutralize its influence.
Containment.
Exactly. It speaks to that deep human need, maybe, to categorize and control things we don't understand, things that scare us. Even if that control is just locking it away and pinning a warning to it, it's an admission of its power, in a way.
Which brings us right back around, full circle, doesn't it? Back to that locked trunk, decades of silence. And back to that curator, the witness who shared this oral history, the guardian of this unsettling object, and their observation. Remember that very first detail we talked about? The one that kind of hooks you into this whole story?
The pin.
The pin. The curator, who knew the history, knew the trunk hadn't been opened, swears that the brass head of that specific pin, the one holding the positively do not touch note to that ancient dress, it shone like it had just been polished that morning.
Despite everything, despite the age, the darkness, the lack of human contact.
Right. The dress is over 100 years old. Falling apart, probably. The trunk sealed for generations, according to their own meticulous records. No one touched it.
It's a complete contradiction.
It totally is. How do you explain that? How does a tiny piece of brass, hidden away in the dark for decades, suddenly gleam like new?
It defies logical explanation, doesn't it?
Completely. What could cause that? What unseen, something, could be responsible for such a subtle yet impossible detail? A silent sign of what? An ongoing presence.
I think, stepping back, that observation by the curator is the perfect quiet encapsulation of this whole cursed object theme we've been tracing.
It's so small, isn't it? Almost imperceptible, just the gleam of a pinhead. But it carries such immense weight. It powerfully suggests, or seems to suggest, an ongoing presence, something active, defying time, defying logic, defying its confinement.
Even in dormancy, it's still doing something.
Well, that's the question of forces, isn't it? Does the doll continue to exert some kind of influence, even locked away?
Yeah.
Or is that gleam just a reminder, a sign that some objects carry an energy, an imprint of their history, of the intense emotions surrounding them, an energy that maybe can't be fully contained or explained away by our normal understanding of the material world?
And we can't know for sure. No. And that's the point, really. With stories like this, we're not looking for a neat, confirmed explanation. The power is the mystery. It's the unanswered questions, the what if, that sticks with you long after you hear the story, long after the trunk lid is notionally closed again. Ultimately, this Vermont doll, it remains this incredibly potent symbol, doesn't it? A symbol of the unexplained, a kind of dark mirror reflecting our own deep-seated anxieties about attachment, about loss, about things we can't control or understand. It invites you to wonder what really lies dormant in the things we forget.
Wow. So from a simple, lovingly made toy for a little girl, to this object of absolute dread, the silent watcher passed down with warnings. This deep dive really shows how an ordinary thing, a rag doll, can become saturated with story, with fear, tales of attachment that just won't let go, a warning that echoes through time, and a mystery that, well, literally still seems to shine in the darkness. It really makes you question how we perceive objects and the histories they carry. Thanks for joining us on this. Pretty unsettling exploration.
It really leaves you thinking, doesn't it, about the life of objects, their legacy, even when they're locked away, forgotten by most. Maybe some artifacts just persist. They seem to have their own internal clock, their own quiet, active presence. The pin still gleams in the dark, defying time, defying explanation. No one knows who or what polished it. And maybe the most unsettling thought isn't just what the doll is, but who or what is still keeping that promise Clara heard all those years ago. Who or what is quietly tending to its presence, ensuring its story and its warning survives, echoing through the silent, unending watch of the night. Something to ponder.